I'm Moya Andrews, and welcome to WFIU's Profiles. Profiles is a weekly program that introduces members of our community, as well as notable visiting artists, scholars, and entertainers, to the WFIU audience. Our guest today is Stuart Green, the Interim Chancellor of Indiana University, Kokomo. Stuart, welcome. We're glad to have you here
in
Bloomington.
It's lovely to be here, Moya.
Tell our listeners about your position on the Kokomo campus.
Well, I'm interim chancellor. What that means is I have a two-year position appointed by President McRobbie when Ruth Person, our previous chancellor, took a position at the University of Michigan, Flint. I had been there for 10 years as chief academic officer, vice chancellor for academic affairs, and President McRobbie wanted me to spend the next 2 years working on some of the strategic issues that I had helped Chancellor Person establish and to finish the work that she had begun. As interim chancellor, I have all of the vice chancellors for academic affairs. Those positions kind of parallel the vice president's position in finance, in student affairs, and in external affairs. That's development and the Office of Communications and Marketing. So those people report to me. I also convene about a 27-person committee called the Administrative Council. And I try, through servant leadership, direct all of the administrators on my campus to work on the things that are most important to our campus, the mission of the institution, teaching and learning, research and service, and especially our student success and our service to the community.
Well, it sounds like you've got your hands full. And especially at this time, Kokomo as a community has some challenges with our economy not being in the best shape. Tell us a little bit about the community in which your campus is located.
Well, Kokomo is about 50 miles due north of Indianapolis. And as you noted, it's having some difficult times in the current economic crisis. Most specifically, it's having a difficult time because the economic heart of the community is built on automotive manufacturing. And its two principal employers are Chrysler and Delphi Electronics. We've lost over 5,000 jobs in that city in the last year or so. And it's a very, very difficult and precarious position to be in right now. In particular, the current discussion about whether GM will be bailed out and Chrysler will be bailed out is on the minds of all of the people in the city of Kokomo. Should those two industries go under, it would be very difficult for the city to survive the loss of those two industries. I don't know if you read Forbes magazine a few days ago online. Kokomo is listed among the 10 cities that are dying the fastest in this country. We were listed number 3.
That is an unenviable title to have.
Yes, it is. So our campus is pretty busy. We have been working on what we call the Regional Leadership Institute. We've taken the position that part of the role of the campus is to be a convener to discuss and to work on solving the major issues that are facing not only the city of Kokomo and the county that it's in, Howard County, but the entire region. So we've been working in a 14-county region, going out and listening to the people in that community, and we've gotten a pretty good handle on what's on their minds. It's healthcare, it's education, it's the economy. And we've invited approximately now 54 leaders from all different sectors of those communities to convene and become a regional leadership institute to grow themselves, to look at different communities across the country that have worked as a region to solve their economic problems, and then to come back and identify 2 or 3 major projects that can cut across counties and cut across regions. And we're pretty excited about it.
Well, this is impressive to think that the university is taking this role and that it feels this close connection to the community and to the whole region. I really am interested in the way that Kokomo has taken this leadership role. And tell me a little bit about the campus, a few statistics about it, how many students you have, et cetera.
We have approximately 2,800 students. We have a School of Arts and Sciences, a Division of Education, a School of Business, a Division of Public and Environmental Affairs, and a thriving School of Nursing. The students are distributed across all of these schools and divisions. We have about 40 different academic programs and 99 full-time faculty and a full complement of 240 employees. Our most recent building that we added was a science building that was named after the founder of the Kokomo campus, Virgil Hunt. So it's named after Virgil and Elizabeth Hunt, and it's called Hunt Hall.
When was the campus founded?
The campus actually began in 1948 as a junior college and was taken over in the late 60s by Indiana University, where it became an extension campus and finally achieved full campus status around 1970 when it had one building. Now it's a campus of multiple buildings. And we've had a great benefit of having many, many wonderful supporters, including a major supporter that's a supporter of this campus that was until he passed away not too long ago. And that was Ed Kelly of the Kelly School of Business. And we have our major student center is named for Ed Kelly, the Kelly Student Center, because Ed was the principal driving force behind not only building that center, but he was a driving force behind growing the Kokomo campus, adding numerous baccalaureate programs, and was one of the inspirational leaders behind us getting an MBA on our campus.
Well, that's wonderful. And do you have any residential students?
We are 100% a commuting campus, although we certainly aspire to be a residential campus. We've seen the kinds of changes, dramatic changes, that has brought to IUPUI, to South Bend, Southeast, and Fort Wayne. So, yes, we have our eye on that prize, but we've got a ways to go before we can realize that dream.
How far do students commute?
Well, typically students commute within about a 45-mile radius. However, students commute all the way from the south side of Indianapolis and some even farther away to participate in our Baccalaureate of Science in Nursing program. It's a very, very popular program. And as you know, nursing is a high-demand course of study. And when they fill up at IUPUI, the students start taking 31 north to IU Kokomo, and we're delighted to have them. In particular, we pull quite a number of minority students from Indianapolis.
So that works out well for everyone.
Oh, it
for
absolutely
you as
does.
Well as for them. Now, what about the part your campus plays in the whole university system? Can you talk a little bit about
sure.
that?
Sure. Well, you know, we are one of eight campuses. There are six regional campuses, and we are one of those regional campuses. And then, of course, there is the Bloomington campus and IUPUI. The regional campuses share a lot in common. They serve largely, even the ones that have residential students, we serve largely a commuter population and largely a first-generation population. So that has certain challenges. I think like all of the different campuses, we're kind of embedded in our community and we get to know our community. And I think that's one of the great things that Herman Wells was able to achieve by distributing these regional campuses all over Indiana.
So they are opportunities for first-generation students to earn. Do you have associate degrees or only baccalaureate degrees?
Well, actually, we went through the mission differentiation process that former President Herbert initiated. And going through that process and with the advent of the community college, we made a very, very serious decision to become a primarily baccalaureate institution with certain select master's degrees. We actually have only one campus-based associate's degree, and that's in radiography. And that's largely because our campus, when it built the science building, created a radiography unit in it, and it was not one of the degrees that Ivy Tech felt should be part of their responsibilities. So we really have focused on being the public baccalaureate institution in our service region of seven core counties and then another four surrounding counties.
And how are you different from the Ivy Tech?
Oh, we're vastly different from Ivy Tech. It's a question of the kind of experience a student has when they go to a baccalaureate institution. First of all, while Ivy Tech is a great institution for a certain kind of student, especially those students that are somewhat more underprepared to go to college and gives them that kind of developmental preparation. When you come to a baccalaureate institution, and our institution in particular, that you're going to have an experience that's quite unique. First of all, you're going to become part of a learning community. These are groups of 45 students that are paired with three faculty members who stay with them for an entire year, teaching them a total of 12 credit hours over the course of that year on one theme. And that creates a cohort of students and a relationship with faculty that you're not going to have at any of the community colleges, in part because it's a unique experience on our campus, but also in part because the community colleges are still relying on huge numbers of part-time faculty, and they're not able to have the time to establish the relationships with students that our faculty have. I think another thing that happens is when you're a student at a baccalaureate institution, any of the regional campuses of IU, you're studying often with full professors in your freshman and sophomore year. You're often involved in undergraduate research with these faculty who are often top-flight researchers in their own fields and in their own right. So there are these kinds of experiences that you have. The other major thing that's unique about a regional campus is that these students, these first-time college students, they're able to have access to programs, opportunities, and experiences, internships, special projects that usually are reserved for the more elite students that show up at a campus like Bloomington. So you could be somebody whose parents never went to college, know nothing about the collegiate experience. Suddenly you find yourself doing undergraduate research as a freshman, working close to a top-flight researcher in biology or in mathematics or in English or in philosophy. And these experiences are tremendously uplifting and transforming for these students. We have students in what we call our Innovation Symposium, going overseas with faculty, taking on actual projects overseas, and then bringing those projects back, writing papers about them, doing projects. We did a thing called the Peace Garden, which was dedicated to the soldiers who died in Pearl Harbor, and was a multicultural experience for our students and for our faculty. And these are the kinds of experiences that typically happen at baccalaureate institutions. I would say, finally, Indiana University prides itself on these close relationships, on having small classes, so that you're getting a comprehensive university experience with a kind of liberal arts feeling to it.
So it's all about relationships and how relationships are an integral part of stimulating the intellectual and imaginative development.
It is all about relationships on our campus.
And that's fascinating. Now, of course, you also, I suppose, have access to resources at other campuses of the system.
Being part of Indiana University brings tremendous opportunities. President McRobbie recently announced the tremendous acquisition for Indiana University of this relationship with Adobe, opening up all of the Adobe software to faculty, students, and staff alike. Our long-term relationship with Microsoft. These are not things that a tiny institution like IU Kokomo could have done on its own. So these are tremendous opportunities. There are other things that IU does for us all the time so that we don't have to do them ourselves. We have access to legal counsel. If we had to retain our own legal counsel, it would cost us thousands and thousands of dollars every year. But we simply have access to the wonderful legal counsel led by Dottie Frapwell. We have access to this remarkable IT network that Brad Wheeler oversees. It's so deep and so broad and so supportive of all of its faculty and of the teaching and learning enterprise. OnCourse, which was developed by an IU faculty member, is a tremendous asset. And we never have to worry about it. We don't have to house the servers on our campus. We don't have to worry about any of those kinds of things. And it goes on and on and on. And also, underscoring all of that is the colleagueship that faculty and administrators share. I spent all of those years as the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, getting to know people like you and all of our other wonderful colleagues. You're never alone. You have a problem, you have a question, there are people to call, people to talk to, not only to get the answers, but to share ideas, share concerns, share problems, problem solve with. And I think it makes for a much stronger and richer and capable university overall.
You brought us some music. I think it's probably time that we had a break and played your first selection. Tell us what it is and why you chose it.
Well, I believe it's Adelaida by Beethoven. It's sung by UC Bierling. This particular piece, and the reason I wanted to play it, is a beautiful, lilting piece, but it's a song. And when you think of Beethoven, you tend to think of symphonies and concertos, but you don't typically think of songs. So I wanted the listeners to be able to hear this remarkably delicate and beautiful song that I thought it was just worth playing, and it's one of my favorites.
We're continuing our discussion with Stuart Green, the interim chancellor of the Kokomo campus of Indiana University. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Stuart, if you could wave a magic wand and change anything about your campus and its role in the system, what would you want to change?
Well, the one thing I would like to change about Indiana University is that with all of its resources and all of its capacity, I think it could and should take on some larger universal statewide challenges. I think that would require all of us to collaborate at a higher level. But I think that's something we could accomplish and could accomplish even more for the state. We have a hint of this in degrees of excellence from President McRobbie. It wasn't something that we were prepared for. It was a terrific idea, the notion of identifying a specific percentage of each of our budgets that would be placed at the service of activities and projects that would help students succeed and graduate faster and at a greater rate. That's something we've done internally, and I think it was a marvelous idea. And it also shows the power of a good idea. Oh, of course, there's something to be said about the power of being president, too. But these are the kinds of things we can do. And the question really is what are the one or two audaciously hairy big ideas out there that Indiana University should be looking at? And there are some out there.
So you're talking about what the university can do in terms of a few prioritizing
That's right.
goals.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And prioritizing the what are the main things for the state.
For the state that IU could affect. And I think that's the one place where I think we could do even more as a university.
We could be more strategic.
More strategic, absolutely.
Well, that's an interesting idea, Stu, and it's a large idea, which are the kinds of ones that are the most exciting. Now, before you were an administrator, you were a full-time faculty member,
yes.
Obviously. Tell us a bit about what you did, what your discipline was.
Well, it still is. I'm in fine arts, and I taught painting and printmaking and design. But I also ended up, in the last few years, teaching music. When I was a young person, I had studied both art and music. I was at the Art Institute of Chicago as an undergraduate, but I was also studying voice at the Chicago Conservatory of Music. And so, as you know, Moya, I've never stopped singing, and it doesn't take much to get me to sing. When I was appointed, Trustee Shoulders observed that I was the only vice chancellor that had ever sung to the Board of Trustees of Indiana University during a board meeting, but he said that they would appoint me as interim chancellor despite the fact that I had sung to them. In recent years, the majority of my teaching has been involved in teaching in this course called Introduction to the Creative Arts. It was actually a course that I helped develop with two other colleagues. And it was based on the need to shift from simply having a series of courses in the arts for education majors to take that didn't involve them in the process. The new standards for teacher preparation wanted to see higher levels of outcome and actual skills achievement. And so we put our heads together and we came up with this integrated curriculum for fine arts that would integrate theater, storytelling, music, and visual arts. And we decided not to do this chronologically in particular, but to look at certain key artists who were at the cutting edge in their period and form bridges or transitions to other periods. And we also looked for artists about whom there was other art. For example, Schaller's play about Mozart, Amadeus. And so one of the artists that we chose was Mozart. We also chose Isaac Dennison, who had a particular love of Mozart and integrated Mozart's music into her writing. For example, in her novella Babette's Feast, she has Achille Papin teaching the first act duet of Don Giovanni to one of these three sisters in this remote Finnish village. In this religious sect, in this Finnish village. And it's a wonderful, wonderful piece. And there's a beautiful little film that is about Babette's Feast. And so they see this, and then we actually show them Don Giovanni and talk about Mozart at length. And so one of the things that I did was I would come in and teach them to sing this duet. All the gentlemen would be taught how to be Don Giovanni's, and all of the young ladies would become Zerlina's, and they would all end up singing this piece. Now, the most interesting part was that Don Giovanni is such an important and popular opera that it's not that difficult to find a production of Don Giovanni even near Kokomo somewhere, typically up in Chicago or somewhere else nearby, and quite frequently down here in Bloomington. So the very first class we ever did this with, we took 120 students and spouses and children and all of that, and we came here to see Don Giovanni. And all was going well. We had coached them in opera etiquette, you know, because things are a little bit different when you go to the opera house. When you clap, when you don't, a whole range of things. And they were ready. What I wasn't ready for was when the strains of La Ci Da Rem La Mano began and the bass baritone began singing, my students started singing along. And the conductor looked around and the artists looked around. And it was fairly hysterical because they were spread all over the auditorium in different seats, and they sang through the entire piece. And then my students complained to me that the artists had performed it in English, but I had made them learn it in Italian.
Oh, but what a wonderful identification the students had.
And they own that piece now.
Yes.
And they own it forever.
And forever.
Forever and ever.
That is a wonderful story.
We try and take advantage of them. Not only here, but Chicago is close enough that I would take students up there. I once taught a course several years ago for the most at-risk students. The then vice chancellor wanted to find a way to help these students be more successful. He asked all kinds of faculty to teach these students. And these were students who were coming to us with 5th, 6th, and 7th grade reading levels, really at-risk students. Mm. And no faculty members wanted to take this course on, so I offered to do it. But I said, I can't teach art history. I need to give them something they'll identify with, something that will move them, something that will connect to them. So I had been reading Joseph Campbell and had been looking at his PBS series with Bill Moyers, The Power of Myth. So I said, I'm going to have these students use The Power of Myth and read the book, watch the videos, talk about these things, read other mythologies. And I wanted to make it come to life for them. So I took them up to Chicago so they could see the art associated with this at the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago, the Egyptian and Assyrian art, but also then to the Field Museum in Chicago, where each group, I broke them into groups, was assigned to work in these areas of study in the museum so that they could link how the mythologies interacted with the physical environment and the cultural environment of these communities and learn something more about that. And they had to come back and do not only presentations but write papers on this. And these were all of these at-risk students. We gave them special workshops, and every one of these students had a 13th grade reading level by the time 8 weeks had transpired. And they had a great time, and I had a great time.
It's a wonderful application of integrating artistic experience.
Absolutely.
with academic goals. And they
really loved it.
That's a very interesting and impressive report. Many students don't get involved with the visual arts. What do you think is so special about the visual arts, since that's where you started off?
All of the other arts are essentially about time. The visual arts are about space. That is, if you think about any other artistic process, what comes at the end or in the middle of a musical piece or of a dance movement or of a poem or of a novel or of a film or of a play, all is predicated on what went before it. You can't – the people who go to the end of a book and read the last sentence, it's meaningless, and they walked off into the sunset. Well, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything unless you have what went before it. So it's – everything that happens in the other arts has to happen over time. In a sequence, over time. The visual arts happen in an instant. It's an epiphany. Loves art history – and has taught art history. The other wonderful thing is art has a capacity to endure over generations. And the message that the artist sent, at least the aesthetic message, has a level of integrity that is rarely seen in the other arts. And that is to say, how many editions of Shakespeare are there? How many editions of Ulysses are there? Editors get in and get to change. They get to alter it. They cut it. They abbreviate it. They do this. They add prologues, epilogues, commentary, this and that. The pyramids of Giza are the pyramids of Giza. Now, they've weathered a little with time.
And they do change.
They do change. They do change. But they're in the essentially in the same location and have pretty much a similar visual impact. The work that's up in museums is roughly the same now. as it was when it was first painted or sculpted and put up. Architecture, another art, has that same enduring quality. What's different is the generation who views it, finding their own meaning, making their own meaning, constructing their own context and meaning out of the lives that they're leading. And I find that absolutely fascinating, that an artist from 5,000 years ago can reach out to somebody tomorrow and make the same kind of connection, bridging time in that remarkable way.
So it's the intersection of each new generation.
Absolutely.
With the enduring themes.
Absolutely.
And of course, you've continued the tradition. Now, do you have curricula requirements on your campus that make it possible to require students to all students to take some art history course?
Well, not necessarily art history, but yes, we
some
do
kind
have
of.
We do have arts and humanities requirements. In fact, as you know, all IU campuses have their general education requirements, and so yes, there's an area of culture and cultural requirements that do include the arts. And you know, I had a little bit of influence with the faculty committees there.
I was
so
wondering.
Yes, that's something that we do. We also are very proud. We launched this past fall our Bachelor of Arts in Fine Arts. I was a faculty member for I still am. It's now been 37 years. And it took us 37 years to get this degree, but we do have it, and that's largely owing to the project that the trustees began by adding additional faculty, initially lecturers, converting adjunct faculty to lecturers. This was partly Miles' project, but partly the Board of Trustees, and I recall very distinctly. I stood up at one point during a Board of Trustees meeting and said, you know, it's not always that the courses are so oversubscribed that suggests that we should have additional faculty. Sometimes, especially at regional campuses, it's precisely because there aren't faculty in those disciplines that we're unable to offer the curriculum. So they gave me permission to add faculty in art and faculty in music, and that became our launching pad for moving into a Bachelor of Fine Arts. You have to always be looking for those opportunities that you can leverage into something that you think your campus needs. And this was a great opportunity provided to us by the Board of Trustees that has really blossomed. There's a tremendous interest. We've had to take over 3/4 of another building with our art studios already to accommodate the different needs of the students.
Tell me a little bit about why you got interested in this career. When did you first know that?
Fifth grade.
As a child, did you know?
Fifth grade. When I was in fifth grade, I was just another fifth grader, and we started having art projects. And suddenly, my teacher, her name was Polly Schlimmer. You remember the names of those teachers that were important to you. She said, I'm coming to your house. I said, oh, what did I do? What did I do? Oh, she said, no, I need to talk to your parents. I was very, very nervous. So she came and talked to my parents and said, your son has this extraordinary gift. You need to do something about it. They said, well, what should we do? Well, she told them that you need to put him in the Art Institute classes for grade school students. And so I was 10 years old. And one Saturday morning, my mother gave me, you know, a couple of bucks and put me on the L train. And I went downtown and walked to the Art Institute and started taking drawing and painting classes. And I kept doing it and doing it. And eventually I earned a scholarship to the Art Institute of Chicago. And that's where I knew I'd become a teacher. And it really didn't happen till I was probably a junior. We had studios on the 18th floor of the Clement Stone Building, which was a big insurance building on 18th in Michigan. And we all had our little spaces that we had. It was a beautiful place. We loved it. It was you could look out off the fire escape and watch the sun rise between the columns of Soldier Field. So it was really very inspiring and lots of fun. And we had a lot of freedom. And in that freedom, we began to talk about each other's work. And it was in that critiquing and discussion that I discovered people began to come to me more and more and more to get critiques because they liked what I had to say. I listened to what they were trying to do, and I would offer them suggestions. And pretty soon, not only were my fellow undergraduates coming to me, but some of the master's degree students were wandering down to the undergraduate section and asking me to come to their private studios and give them critiques. So I said, this is really fun. I could really do this. So I actually ended up, when I graduated, getting a fellowship to Rochester Institute of Technology, and it was actually a program to develop community college teachers in fine arts. Oh. And so I actually went through actual training and internships and courses on teaching in the community college and in fine arts. And so that's what I wanted to pursue.
Well, you were perfectly prepared. And then the next question, why did a faculty member in fine arts decide that administration was fun?
Well, that was kind of curious. The fact is that I had been on this campus, on my campus for since 72, and it was now 1980. And as I told you, we didn't get a Bachelor of Arts and Fine Arts until this year. So I was getting kind of lonely in terms of the arts. The campus was doing what it needed to do to get an MBA program and all of those kinds of things. But the arts really, I wasn't getting very much support. And in fact, I had gotten a number of people very excited about refurbishing a building in the downtown of Kokomo. But then Chancellor Bogle said, no, we're not interested in doing that. We're going to work and put our resources in the MBA. So I kind of felt disappointed. And then we got a new chancellor, Hugh Thompson, late Hugh Thompson. And Hugh worked with a few of his people in the administration to craft a new mission statement. Well, he didn't ask any faculty about what that mission statement should look like. He didn't consult, but he brought this mission statement to the floor of the Faculty Senate. And he wanted it passed. And I didn't like the mission statement. I didn't think it reflected who we were or what we should aspire to. So I stood up in the Senate and made a speech and spoke against it. And it was defeated. The next day, I got a call from his secretary saying that the chancellor wanted to see me that afternoon in his office. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what have I done? You know, this is terrible. I walked into his office and he had me sit down and he chit-chatted for a second. And then he turned to me and he said, Stuart, how would you like to be the chair of humanities? I said, well, really? He said, yes. I think you're an independent thinker. You have you're bold enough to speak your mind. We need some change. We need some energy in that area. How about it? And I said yes. And within a week, I was writing grants and doing that kind of work and picked up the position officially on July 1st. And then the following year, I became an interim dean of arts and sciences and then dean of arts and sciences for 16 years. And it just kept on going.
And so it went. Let's talk a little bit about our next music selection. I think it's the Puccini.
Nessun Dorma?
It is.
Okay. Nessun Dorma, it means no one shall sleep. It's the most famous aria from Turandot by Puccini.
Well, let's hear it.
Let's listen to it. Stanza,
I believe, Stu, that you have two sons?
Two, yes.
And tell us about them. Have they followed in your footsteps?
Well, not exactly. Both of them are well-educated. Both of them did their undergraduate work here in Bloomington. Alexander was a biology major, and Joseph was a CIS major, Computer Information Systems, in the Kelly School of Business. Alex went on to IU Med and graduated from IU Med, and he is currently at Loyola University Hospitals in his second cardiology fellowship in electrophysiology. And he will finish that on June 30th, 2010. And he absolutely loves the work that he's doing. He's very excited about it. Joseph is a patent attorney in Washington, D.C., with a small boutique firm, Rothwell, Figg, Ernst & Manbeck. Joseph, interestingly, he graduated in 2001, as did Alex from med school. 2001, as we know, was when 9/11 occurred, and I was pretty terrified because they lived about 3.5 blocks from Sears Tower, which seemed to be and actually was a potential target for another terrorist attack. But at the same time, something else happened in 2001. That was when the dot-com bubble burst. And suddenly there were no really great jobs in this area that he had studied. In fact, many of his friends went to their jobs only to be handed a bonus check that they had been promised and then told there was no job. I'm telling this because we're in this other economic crunch right now. So what happened to him was, and this is my advice for anyone else in these situations, he took a job with CDW as a salesperson, a computer discount warehouse. He did it for a while, and then he decided this was not for him. And after a few months of this, he said, I don't need a job, and I think this is really a great way to frame it. I don't want a job. I want a career. And he went back to law school, went to school again, went to law school. He actually, I'm very proud of him, as you can tell. He called me up and said, Dad, after his first year, I need something other than just being a lawyer. So I want to be a patent lawyer, but I don't have enough science or engineering to sit for the patent bar. So while he was in law school, he took 41 additional hard science credits, including organic chemistry and physics and everything else, so he could go sit for the patent bar, which he did and passed. And so he's having a great time. They're both married. Janine and I have two lovely grandchildren, a little boy, Ethan, with Alex and Karen, and a beautiful girl, Lily, with Joe and Eileen.
Well, I'm sure that some of this they learned at their mother and father's knee. What advice do you have for parents who are wanting their children to do well in college? Do you have any advice from your own experiences?
Yes, I do. Not everything is learned in school. I think it's critically important that you expose your children to reading, that you're a reader yourself, that you share books with your children at all ages. I think it's incredibly important to sit at a dinner table and have conversation and talk about ideas, not just chit-chat. It's important to challenge your child to defend his or her ideas, not harshly, but to help them understand that they have to develop, and by doing this will develop, their critical thinking faculties. I think finally, children of all ages need to be exposed to the arts, not only to great literature, but also to paintings, to museums, to theater, to dance. I have to say, in both of my sons' lives, two things impressed their teachers. For Alex, when he was interviewing at IU Med, the thing they found most compelling weren't his very good board scores, MCAT scores, or his high grades. It was the fact that he was a French minor. And I had insisted that he pursue those interests because the medical school wants students who are not just single-purpose Robotitons, they want students who have a variety of interests and that are humanists as well.
And well-rounded.
Well-rounded. And Joseph, what impressed his, I can't recall which teacher it was, but it was curious, and you just heard the selection. The thing that impressed the most was that some teacher played, I think, Nessun Dorma, and said, does anybody know what that is? So Joseph said, well, that's Nessun Dorma from Turandot, and I think it's Pavarotti singing it. So having that well-rounded experience in the arts is so valued by so many people that it's important to expose your children to it.
That's good advice. Now, you have done a lot of interesting things in your life, but you've obviously had to deal with a lot of tough issues as part of your administrative duties. But what's impressive is that you always seem to have a positive attitude and enjoy life. Can you tell our listeners the secret of your successful career and, more especially, your goodwill?
Well, it's true. I am a very, very, very positive person. I have to say that I don't know that it is a secret. I was having this conversation with somebody just the other day, so it's very timely. I think you have to be prepared for the next good thing to happen. You have to work hard, study hard, be courageous. And by being courageous, I mean don't be afraid. If you have that question, to look foolish by raising your hand and asking the question. I guarantee you there'll be many, many people who didn't raise their hand that will be saying, oh, thank God he or she raised his or her hand, because I had the same question. So I was always that person who asked the question. I was always that person that was willing to say, here's an idea. Here's another idea. Well, here's another idea. But also to let other people take and shape those ideas. And I think that's part of it, is that if you decide that you have to own everything, you can't be successful, especially working in an organization. You have to let these ideas bubble up, nurture them, move them along, tweak them with your own ideas from time to time.
Give them into other people's custody.
Give them into other people's custody and let them take ownership of them. And then praise them and celebrate them when they're a success. If you feel it all has to come to you, you will not be successful. The other thing in terms of optimism is you have to let people fail. If you're going to take the risk of having all kinds of good ideas out there, some of them won't work. And so you have to let people know that you'll support them, even if there's a failure from time to time. So I think when you keep coming back and doing that, that really helps. And finally, this is back to mythology. Wherever you stub your toe or stumble, that's where your treasure will be. In all of these difficult circumstances that one finds oneself in, if you step back, take a look, you're going to find some opportunity embedded in there somewhere. So that's kind of what I've always tried to do. And I think that's why people, when they look at me, they say, well, he's a kind of an optimistic sort, and because they're right.
Well, I think this is a wonderful place for us to play our last music selection, which is Stephen Foster's I Dream of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair. You might like to tell us, though, I think I'm guessing why you chose that one.
Well, no, tell me why. What you think.
I think you're thinking about your wife, Jeanine.
Well, absolutely. Firstly, the name Jeannie is very close to Jeanine. And secondly, she has that kind of blithe spirit. And now that we're at Kelly House at IU Kokomo, and we have all these little animals running around, a herd of deer and groundhogs and foxes, it's very apt. But also, again, this particular song takes a composer that's not regularly known as somebody who is an art song composer. People think of Stephen Foster as this guy who wrote these things that you play the banjo to. And here they get to hear this song sung so artfully by UC Bierling, and it's so touching and so gentle and so wonderful. And it does remind me an awful lot of Jeanine.
Well, I think that's a wonderful selection, a wonderful explanation of why you chose it. And it's been terrific for me to have this conversation with you, Stu. We have known each other a long time. We've worked together. And I've always been impressed by the breadth of your interests. But also, I think our listeners will agree that Kokomo Campus is in very good hands. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Moya.
I'm Moya Andrews for Profiles. Thank you for listening.
The program you have just heard was recorded in December of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.